As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. Good bumper music.
Thank you.
That theme song is just
it's iconic.
Yeah. It's the exact word I wanted to say. So I'm very excited for this segment, and I'm very excited for this guest, because I think since moving back to Wisconsin, the buzzwords that have been thrown around, and I don't want to just say them as buzzwords, because they are serious and they are things that people should be worried about, but I feel like there's a lot more understanding of what things like cash bail mean and parole and what are the rules around parole and, in general, rising crime and what are the mechanisms in place within the system to actually curb crime. And it's something that I think it's thrown around a lot in very visually violent ads as far as how they describe things. But it's not necessarily anything, even for those of us who try to pay attention, can really wrap our heads around. Like, my mom called me and was like, "What is this cash bail thing?" And I tried to explain it as best as I understood it, but I don't even want to say it on the air because I don't want to spread more information in case I got it wrong. So our guest for the rest of this, for most of the rest of the show, is Jessa Nicholson, who's a private bar criminal defense attorney who focuses on violent felony defense. Welcome to the show, Jessa. Oh, can we hear you? So there we go. There we go. Now we can hear you.
Now we're good.
All now right, we're good.
Perfect.
So thank you so much for being here. So let's start there, as far as hopefully my mother is listening. And so the first time I ever learned about why cash bail is a classist institution is when I was still living in New York, and the conversations around Rikers and the fact that you, as a person who has not actually been convicted of anything yet, if you're just poor and you can't afford bail, then you're basically being held because you're poor, even though you actually haven't gone through the trial yet. And so, but to back up, then there's also, as we record this show in Waukesha right now, obviously we're coming up on the year anniversary of what started the entire conversation in the more public sphere of cash bail, which was the Waukesha Parade tragedy. And so I know this is a passion of yours as far as where we stand in Wisconsin with it. So I guess let's just start with, what is cash bail?
Sure. And one thing that I want to start out by making sure everybody understands is that cash bail is fairly unique to the United States. Of the Western world, only the United States and the Philippines routinely use the system of cash bail for pretrial detention. So most European countries do not use this. Most other countries in North America don't use this. And I think people really lose that conversation just as a beginning, that it's very American to decide that you need to be able to pay money to establish that you're not a safety risk. And, you know, that's just not the way that the rest of the world works. And I think that's important to keep in mind. But cash bail is essentially governed here in Wisconsin by you have a constitutional right under both the federal and state constitutions to reasonable bail, whatever that means. And cash is used under the theory that sometimes people are unlikely to come to court, and so they need to have skin in the game. Okay, this is the idea, that if you give us some of your money that we can take away from you, if you don't show up, you're more likely to show up in court. The problem with that, and I'm going to give away where I am on cash bail pretty quickly here. The problem with that is that the actual data doesn't support that conclusion at all, and it never has. And that's what we don't talk about a lot, is people take that as this common sense. Well, yeah, I mean, if you post a lot of money, you're more likely to show up. No, not true at all. And I can cite, I won't bore your listeners with the massive quantity of statistics I have to support this, but I promise you they're out there, and I can give you several resources at the end of our conversation if you want to read more.
We want to post it on our blog post. But that, I think, the insinuation there is that there is people who do pay the money and then still don't show up for jail. I mean, for court.
And so, yep, that's the first thing. And the other thing is, predictors of people's willingness to make themselves available for court are actually the things that you expect about strong ties to the community. It's, do they have family here? Do they have children here? Do they have a job here? Do they own a home here? Have they lived here their entire life? What access do they have to travel? Do they have a passport? Do they have anywhere to flee to? There are a lot more social factors that keep people showing up for court than just if there's money on the line. And here, you know, we don't have bail bonds people in Wisconsin. We're one of very few states that don't do that. You have to post the whole amount. And so a lot of times it ends up not even being the money of the defendant. It ends up being their parents' money or family friends or community organizers that raise money to post bail in certain cases. So the idea that you're actually even extracting this sort of fee from a defendant is somewhat fictitious on its face.
So we're talking to Jessa Nicholson, who's a private bar criminal defense attorney, and we're talking about cash bail. And so what are the, because the argument is that it keeps violent people off the street, right? And that was that people are getting released without bail or very low bail and then going and redoing more violent crime. And so how much of that, in your experience, has been individual cases versus an actual trend?
Oh, it's absolutely individual cases. And what happens, okay, what happens is exactly what we see happening in Waukesha, is somebody was released on a low bail and probably committed, I mean, I think we've all watched parts of the Brooke trial over the past several weeks, pretty clearly committed some heinous offenses. Like, you know, the jury is going out, I think, later today if they finish their closings and instructions. So I don't want to say too much about that, but I have expectations about what those verdicts are going to be. So somebody does something like that, and then everyone loses their minds and says, like, how could this person have been out? Well, okay, let's back up just a minute. Every person in the United States has the presumption of innocence mm-hmm. when they're charged with a crime. And whether or not it appears that they are guilty from the criminal complaint and from, you know, what is reported in the press, whether or not they appear guilty, that presumption still matters. And so when people say, well, we're letting violent criminals out with low bail, well, there's been no trial. At the time they set bail, there's been no preliminary hearing, which in felony cases is how you establish probable cause. There might have been an affidavit, you know, we call it a Riverside affidavit, that establishes some bare minimum probable cause. But none of the facts have really been flushed out. You've got our allegations on a piece of paper, some of which might be true and often are true, because lots of people who are charged with crimes are guilty, but some aren't. And we start with this presumption of innocence. So, you know, when I hear people say that, well, how do you know he's a violent criminal? Well, it looked like he did that. Well, okay, it does look like that. But don't you think there should be a process to decide if he actually did that or if it just looks like that? Well, hey, that process is actually called a trial. And when you skip all of those steps and incarcerate somebody because they look guilty and they're poor, or you set cash bail an amount that even not poor people have no hope of reaching. And, you know, we're seeing that when you look at, there's this bill pending in the Wisconsin legislature that purports to sort of set standards for, oh, well, okay, if it's an H felony, we'll set $2,500 cash. If it's a, it has this sort of graduated proposal. Well, you know, not everyone that commit or is charged with these crimes are going to have that. A lot of people don't have an extra $5,000. I mean, I think we learned that from the pandemic, that most Americans were saying they didn't have an extra $500. And that's mm-hmm. why we had to see all of the assistance that we saw from 2020 forward with people and small businesses, because the fact of the matter is most people don't carry that type of savings around. It's actually a pretty privileged position to come from.
And so with that, so the, there is still a discretion though of a who, because there is, how do I want to word this? Beyond cash bail, there's options also when someone is arrested, that because they do pose a threat, that whether it's a, I'm assuming it's a judge that says there is no bail.
Yep. And so let's talk about that specifically in Wisconsin. So first of all, you're hitting on the two things that cash bail are supposed, or that bail bond is supposed to do. It's supposed to assure the defendant's appearance in court, which is where cash is supposed to be considered. And it's supposed to protect the public. Now, the plain language of Chapter 969 of the Wisconsin statutes, which is the bail statute, says a few things that I think our government skips over often. Number one, non-monetary conditions are what are supposed to protect the public. Let me give you some examples of those. Let's say I get into a fight with my husband and I punch him in the face. And so I'm arrested for that battery. And he's probably listening and laughing about this as I say that. And in an effort to protect the public from my violent face punching, they say, well, okay, the target of her ire was her husband. So we're going to order no contact between her and her husband because that protects him, the victim, from me. That has nothing to do with what cash I post. It's a totally separate consideration, but they can do that. Or they can say, you know what? You were peeking around in windows, and that's pretty creepy. So we're going to put you on pretrial services. We're going to put an ankle bracelet on you and track your movements. And we're going to restrict you from being out in the middle of the night peeking in windows. We're going to say, you threatened, you know, whatever the facts of the case are, you threatened to blow the school up. So we're going to put a provision in place that says you can't go back to the school. You have to stay away from the school. Those are sort of non-monetary conditions that can be imposed in any case and can be individually tailored to suit the facts of any individual case. So they can actually address more head on what public safety concerns are. Cash, on the other hand, isn't supposed to be used to say, well, we'll just incarcerate you while you wait for trial. It's supposed to be used only to assure your appearance in court. And so the second part of your question is, are there other things you can do to protect the public? Yes, almost every county in the state has some form of pretrial services where they can, you know, order check-ins with the sheriff department or put somebody on electronic monitoring. Here in my home county, Dane County, we have a whole unit that will breath test people if we're concerned that they're consuming alcohol and that elevates their risk. We can do drug testing pretrial and make sure that they're maintaining sobriety, which is, again, another potential risk factor for reoffense. So there are a lot of those tools. The second thing that's important to know is that Wisconsin law actually has a provision. Oh, but I'm getting a signal.
Well,
so
we have 1 minute left. So we'll hold on to that thought and we'll talk about because you're here for most of the hour. Jessa Nicholson,
I vibrated a really high frequency. So just
I love it. Better that than a low frequency. And it's like, can bring up the energy, Jessa. Our guest this hour is Jessa Nicholson, who is a criminal defense attorney who focuses on violent felony crimes. She is clearing up some of the myths about crime and parole and cash bail. Stick with us. She will be here and I will be here when we come back. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Nice, Jade, because our guest this hour is a lawyer, Jessa Nicholson.
It's not bad advice.
I've always told Jade, as long as you can make us laugh as we start the segment, that's a win. And she's very good at it. Our guest this hour is Jessa Nicholson, who's a private bar criminal defense attorney who focuses on violent felony defenses. And she is here talking more detail in layman's terms of cash bail and parole and rising crime. And we were finishing up talking about options when someone is arrested and they haven't had a trial yet. And cash bail has been the kind of the thing of, well, these DAs are setting such low bail, blah, blah, blah. But you were explaining that there is other options as far as public safety beyond just post saying that you have to pay $2,000, $5,000,
$10,000. Right. And the other thing that I was saying is, if you really think someone is so dangerous that they shouldn't be entitled to bail, we have a procedure for that. It exists. You can have a whole hearing where the defendant has real due process rights. It's not a beyond a reasonable doubt standard, but it's a lower standard that the state would call witnesses to establish the public safety risk that somebody is. And the problem with that from a prosecutor's perspective is that that's only available to them in very serious felony crimes. So what happens is they have somebody that doesn't fit that criteria. It's like armed robbery, homicide, felony murder, murder for hire, these really high-end serious crimes. It doesn't exist for something like an OWI fifth offense. It doesn't exist for false imprisonment or for strangulation and or stalking.
Or domestic violence, does that?
No.
Yeah.
I mean, unless it's an attempt homicide or something. And so what happens is we set prohibitive cash bail to avoid, number one, addressing the fact that perhaps there's a gap in public safety protection, you know, for anything but these high level crimes. But number two, as a defense attorney, the state doesn't want to have to give me their evidence any earlier than they absolutely have to. So they don't want to have to go through a hearing and tell me what their witnesses are going to say that early on to a case. It's easier to skip that process for them and just incarcerate the guy. And we've got a system that allows it. So why give me that process? I mean, that's a cynical view, but it's the one that I certainly adopt because I've had that conversation with prosecutors. If you really want to keep him in, you know, if you really want to keep my client in, have the hearing. You have a statutory ability to do it. They won't do it. They'd rather just set the high cash.
So, okay. My mind is going in a million different directions right now. It sounds like there is multiple different avenues, mechanisms, tools beyond just cash bail that are available, whether that's actually like what you were just saying, it's a very high bar to just not let someone out in between their trial and the hearings, but then also no contact, an ankle monitor, and all these other things. And so when people are saying these kind of on the political ads as far as, oh, cash bail, low cash bail, what do you want to say to them when you, like, do you want to throw your shoe through the TV when those ads come
on? All the time. It's maddening because, first of all, it totally erodes the presumption of innocence. And I know that the general public doesn't care about that the way lawyers do, but you should. You really, really, really should, because you can be crime-free your whole entire life, but you can do absolutely nothing to avoid being falsely accused of a crime. There's nothing you can do to prevent yourself from being falsely accused of a crime. And if you are, and you're poor, or you just don't have the $50,000 that some 26-year-old prosecutor thinks is necessary to assure your appearance, then you're going to lose your job. You're going to lose your housing. You're not going to see your kids. You're going to be grossly restricted from having access to your lawyer. Because your lawyer has to go to the jail to see you and meet with you to prepare for trial, which is a massive pain. So there are all sorts of things that we can do instead of that. But people are afraid. They're afraid of criminals. They're afraid of violent crime. And so it's this really quick solution that has intuitive sense, right? You think, well, the higher the cash, I guess it'd probably be hard for them to get out, and then it would be, they wouldn't want to leave it. Except again, the social science data just doesn't support that conclusion. It just doesn't. And that's why our federal system has moved away from cash bail. That's why you see major cities all over the United States ending cash bail. I mean, Philadelphia, Larry Krasner's work out there has been great. There are a ton of, the whole state of Pennsylvania has a bail project that's working on eliminating it. We're seeing this everywhere because people are starting to listen to the science. And, you know, for lefties in particular, I see so many signs that say science is real. Well, science should be real when it comes to recidivism too. That we should talk about the fact that violent criminals actually have lower recidivism rates than nonviolent criminals. We should talk about the, you know, cash bail doesn't actually ensure people's appearance. Like, that's social science, and that's real.
And with the 2 minutes we have until we have to go to another break, I don't know if this is opening a bigger can of worms than I want, but at one point, the last time we had lawyers on the show, we were talking about the lawsuit against, because of the crisis of public defenders. And I had tried to ask the question of how much do these two things overlap as far as prosecutors setting low cash bail because of the public defender. And they tried to make it sound like those two things don't correlate at
well,
all.
Well, except what they're missing, and I can do this succinctly. What they're missing is part of the reason that you can't get private bar lawyers to take PD overflow cases is the cost. Okay. They don't pay lawyers enough. Like, I don't take PD cases for that reason and others. But more importantly, when you have a client that's in custody, every time you visit them, it's like half a day. And so when you have these people who can't afford to get out of custody on these low-level offenses, it almost mandates that you're sort of a crappy lawyer for them because you can't communicate with them the same way you communicate with your out-of-custody clients. So I do think that if more clients were out-of-custody pretrial, it would be easier for more lawyers to take those cases. I do see that correlation.
Oh, that's interesting. All right. Well, I have so many questions. Okay, we're going to take another break, but Jessa Nicholson will still be here when we come back to talk more about parole and rising crime rates and what she wishes you knew about being a criminal defense lawyer. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Stick with us.
And lucrative vocation. So I set out on a journey to become an attorney without a moment's hesitation. But here's some free advice I'm giving. When it comes to deciding what to do for a living, don't be a lawyer. Don't do it. Quickest way to ruin your life.
Trying to crawl through all of the work that we have to do. Whereas the time gone, this chapter so long, feels like I'm up every night until 2. Yeah.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. Our guest this hour is Jessa Nicholson, who's a private bar criminal defense attorney who focuses on violent felony defense. I think I got my questions answered about cash bail. Jane, do you have any more questions on cash bail?
Just in general, Jessa.
Yeah.
I think people wonder, why should that scumbag get a lawyer? And I realize that you kind of addressed that in the last segment, because if it's you, you're going to be glad that you get a defense lawyer. But I do think that there's an attitude among some people when the crime that the accuser is, or the accused is facing, is so heinous. And it's just like, well, we should just hang him.
Well, I'm sorry those people don't like living in America. They should move. Because as much of an effort as some politicians are making to eradicate our constitutional rights, you actually have a Sixth Amendment constitutional right to a lawyer. And to me, it's an absolute tragedy and a joke that some of the people that waved the flag the absolute most broadly make comments that cut at the absolute heart of our constitutional protections. So, you know, sure, you're welcome to feel that way, but you're living in the wrong country.
That's a really good answer.
I mean, but there are countries where you don't get due process, right? Or at least
absolutely, yeah. There are countries that you start guilty and then you have to prove your innocence. We're just not one of them.
Yeah. That was a really good answer, because I think certainly in these times with crime rising, and I would say we live in an area of you live in Dane County. I grew up in Madison. Talk radio, especially right wing talk radio, not really a thing in Dane County.
Just Vicky McKenna.
Is Vicky in Madison?
Yeah, she's in Madison.
I didn't know.
And she's had me
that
on her show. So.
Really? Oh, that's a whole other conversation. I would love to. Maybe we'll get a drink over that, because I would love to hear how that was. But in Southeast Wisconsin, a lot of right wing radio, and a lot of these talking points that are not that go beyond just the political ads, that are year round as far as those people, those criminals. And so to hear you kind of cut through that noise as easily as you did, and not with no ums or buts about it. It's this is our country, this is our constitution, and they have a right to a lawyer. So I appreciate that.
I'm just proud I didn't swear while I did it.
Thank you. Jane, thanks you. So I know this is probably, because you obviously, as a criminal defense lawyer, you are more involved in the case and the trial versus once someone is convicted and has served their time, and when things get to parole. But I imagine you still know more about parole than Jane and I do.
Well, I do, particularly because I'm so glad you asked this. One of the reasons that you see Wisconsin incarcerating 4 times the amount of people that Minnesota does, despite having virtually identical populations, is that over 30% of the people that are in Wisconsin jails and prison right now are there for violations of their parole, not for committing new crimes. We call it extended supervision, not parole, but it's the same basic concept. Yeah. It's the time that you're supervised after you're released.
And what are the typical, because obviously I think what we get, we hear in the news and what's scary is when someone violates their parole and they do another crime, especially another violent crime, versus what the little I do know about parole or extended supervision is there's a bunch of different rules as far as you can't be with another criminal. You can't be around alcohol. Like the event that I talked about being at last night with the community, the two co-founders of that organization are convicted felons, and they've been out, but they can't have alcohol in their events. And so how often are those, that 30% that's back in jail or back in prison, is it kind of petty violations versus actual crimes again?
Sure. So that statistic, I think, is from 2018. So it might be, you know, like that's a little bit dated now, but I think it's still pretty consistent. If anything, you see that there was this huge trend to try and stop that, which got it down to 30%. It used to be higher than that. But, you know, a third of people that we're talking about are there because, you know, they opened a line of credit without their agent's permission, or operated a motor vehicle without their agent's permission, or had contact with their children without their agent's permission, or went on a date without their agent's permission. Now, some of those are specific to the type of crime you might have been convicted for, but the rules of extended supervision are very far-reaching. It can be that you don't have a stable address. People, you know, because you're supposed to keep your address up to date. Certainly people who struggle with addiction will have, you know, violations for alcohol or drug use, which is a crime in and of itself, but I would suggest it's not the type of crime that people typically assume incarceration is the end result of. So there are a lot of different things. You can fail to meet with your agent. You can fail to complete treatment programs, whether or not you have access to the resources and the time that are required of those programs. So, I mean, you can be ordered to participate in a program that's going to cost $12,000. You have no access to the $12,000 worth of programming. You fail to complete your programming, and you can be put on a hold or given some sanction that's a 30, 60, 90-day jail sentence just for failing to complete.
And, Jessa, if you do violate your parole, and I'm sure it's individual cases, how much extra time can that tack on to you?
So here in Wisconsin, we have what's called truth in sentencing. So we now sentence everybody to a period of initial confinement and a period of extended supervision. So let's say I got in trouble. I got 1 year in, 4 years out. So 4 years of what you guys are calling parole. Even if I perform perfectly for 3 years and 7 months of my extended supervision, if I commit disorderly conduct or, you know, whatever my violation is, if it's a new crime or I just, you know, develop a heroin habit, I don't know. Whatever's going on, even if I've made it that 3 years and 7 months, when my supervision is revoked, I face up to that 4 years again. So you don't get credit for your street time, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And my mind goes to, isn't that very expensive for taxpayers?
So expensive. And do you know what? It is so much less expensive to hire alcohol and drug counselors and social workers than to reincarcerate those people. But, you know, why would we do that?
Well,
that
just
makes too much sense.
Well, you just said as far as the $12,000 that they can't afford to go to some kind of rehab program is a fraction of what it costs to
incarcerate someone
for a year. Yeah,
there is.
And there, when people get out, I can't even wrap my head around the challenges that they're facing and how they have to curate their friends and curate their family, and you have to avoid these people and I can't go here. And so where are they supposed to be getting their support from so they can do their 4 years on extended supervision and not break any of those?
Well, I can tell you it's not from the Department of Corrections, because of the five, I think I've done five revocation hearings, which is the hearing to take you back to prison this year. And out of those, three of the five that I did, the agent seeking to revoke my client's supervision had never met my client.
Wait, how's that?
They they're filling in for another agent. They've never even met the person. They don't know what the issues are. They can't speak to what type of options were given by the prior agent. They can't pick my client out of a lineup, so to speak, but they're there seeking to remove their freedom. So it's not the Department of Corrections. And I would also point out, with the restrictions on, you know, contact with gang members or felons, I'm using air quotes, the radio can't see me, but when I say gang members, number one, I don't even know what that means for purposes of rural Wisconsin, like the buttercream gang and the outsiders, I guess, are hanging out, staying gold and, you know, handing each other whippets. But A, I don't know what it means. B, you know, a lot of people don't tell other people when they're felons. So I'm not sure how we're all supposed to know what our friends did when they were in high school, particularly because you can't just search a national criminal history the same way you can search CCAP. So like, if you've got a friend who stole a car when they were 17 and has a felony conviction and you're hanging out with them now when you're 41, you probably don't know that about them.
Yeah. So with the time that we have left, I guess in the same political ads that have been thrown out there, what do you wish people knew about parole?
And the- Well, I wish that people knew that many, many people struggle with readjusting to life outside of the institution. And when I say that people have no support, I mean, clients, number one, people don't pay attention to you when you're in prison. Sometimes parents do, but a lot of people, you know, while they're in prison, their parents die or their family has given up on them because they've screwed things up several times. So when they get out of prison, they're given $30 and a bus ticket, and they're told to start their entire life over with the constant pressure of being afraid that you're going back. Now, we can have this like purity test where we insist that everyone should perform perfectly. But in my view, I've never met a person whose private life absolutely survives public scrutiny. Yeah. And I think that we don't give people a lot of grace to go from, you know, this from zero, totally starting over, to living an exemplary life. We give them no grace at the same time for failure, and we give them no tools for success. So, you know, I think people should keep in mind that it's nobody's plan A to go to prison, and it's nobody's plan A to be a drug addict, and it's nobody's plan A to be homeless. And it's very easy for the rest of us to say, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, but these people don't have boots.
Yeah. Well, similar but different question then. What do you wish people knew about your job or your profession?
Sure. Over and over again, every cocktail party I go to, people say to me, how do you defend guilty people? No one ever asks prosecutors, how do you sleep at night knowing that you incarcerate innocent people? How do you sleep knowing that this 17-year-old with no resources and who has an IQ of 67 is going to spend 10 years in prison because you thought that's what something was worth? That would be a lot harder for me to sleep at night. To me, when I defend someone, number one, I don't care if they're guilty or innocent because I'm not defending their behavior. I'm defending the United States Constitution. I'm defending the fact that every citizen of this country has the right to a zealous defense. Number two, I should never win a case. If the prosecution does their job correctly, then don't worry. My guy's going to be convicted. If he's guilty, you've got him. You don't need to judge me. You don't need to stress out about me. Stress out about prosecutors. That's what's frustrating. Is the other thing that I would tell you is, you know what? Sometimes people do bad things and they're still worthwhile people. There are very few clients I've ever had that I couldn't find a redeeming quality in. Most of them are really lovely people who have just made bad mistakes. And I think that people miss that all the time, you know? And then I guess the last thing I'd say is, and this is more directed, I guess, again, to the left. So often we'll see this outrage about, oh my God, this white collar criminal only got 3 years in prison. Okay, 3 years in prison is a long epic time. Okay, so the question should really be, why are these poor people of color getting 10 years in prison? Not why did this one person get a light sentence? It's we should reform sentencing altogether and find better ways to do this, because, and this is a topic for a different time, Incarceration doesn't work as a means to prevent future crime. So we should be talking about that. But instead, we'd like to punish people and just repeat the same mistakes over and over again ad infinitum.
Well, that is the point that no one can ever come back from, is like, if guns and incarceration made us all safer, this would be the safest country in the world, probably.
Exactly.
So, all right. Is there anywhere people can find more information about you or your work or anything you would like people to check out in this time of crime being on top of everyone's mind?
So my office website, nglawyers.com, is just about all of the trials I've won, which is a fascinating read, but probably not so interesting. I would point people to, if people are interested in hearing me talk, I actually did a legal podcast for 3 years called Getting Off. It's on Spotify.
It's a great name.
So we did, my former business partner and I did 4 episodes just on the issue of cash bail that are called Bail Wars. So if people are interested, pull up Spotify, search for the podcast Getting Off, and you can listen to me talk for like 7 hours about cash bail with expletives.
With expletives. The cherry on top will be there. Well, Jessa Nicholson, thank you so much. We will absolutely have you back every time we have legal questions, because this was a delight.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Well, have a great day. We will catch up soon. Stick with us as we wrap up the show. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
In my nights up, making highlights now. Me my rights, I'm under arrest, held captive by tests, and drowning in debt, I'm dying inside, I'm out.